Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What shortcuts does your mind use to process information and make decisions, and how do those shortcuts compare with what we perceive and do when our brains instead take the long way in making judgments? Human brains are unquestionably remarkable and efficient, and occasionally even brilliant. But as my guest today will discuss, they are also highly fallible, and they make it difficult for us to tell when they're perceiving reality and steering us toward objectively wise actions, and when they leave us to make do with close enough. Daniel Kahneman is a Nobel laureate in economics and professor of psychology and public affairs emeritus at Princeton University. He explores some of the ways our minds work in his new book, Thinking, Fast and Slow. Daniel, welcome to Think.
Happy to be there.
So in this book, you write about these two systems of thinking. System one is so fast as to feel instantaneous. What do we use it for?
Well, we use it to get along our lives. It's the one that's It's everything that is automatic, that we do automatically. So we perceive the world automatically, we walk, we drive, we think, we get answers to simple questions like 2 plus 2, the 4 comes immediately to mind. And basically, if we think of routine, the routine of our life, it's automatic. We pay very little, we don't have to work very hard to carry out our activities of the day, mostly.
And what it also does is take past experiences and sort of instantaneously turn them into something that we recognize as having seen before, and we feel like we can go with that assumption.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that are truly marvelous about the human memory and the human associative system is how quickly it processes information and classifies it as, well, this is normal, or this is abnormal. And if it's abnormal, you're surprised and your attention is drawn to it. You process it more deeply. If it's normal, you carry on.
Of course, we can get sloppy with this, so that if I meet someone new and think she looks like my first grade teacher and automatically like her for a reason I don't recognize, she may or may not be a nice person.
Absolutely. And you will falsely recognize people as your teacher. And certainly if you do that, this is what's going to happen to you. If you like the teacher, you like that person.
Mm-hmm. So system two is what we actually recognize as thinking. Is that correct?
That's right. I mean, this is conscious thinking. This is the kind of thinking or mental activity that we feel we are the author of. We feel a sense of agency. I feel this is what I'm doing. So that is system two. System one sort of offers you things, ideas and thoughts, and they come up automatically. You don't feel you're the author of them. You feel they just happen.
But system one is always under the surface, I guess, whispering to system two, even though we don't realize it.
Absolutely. Because system one, in some sense, automatic activities never rest. The brain is always active. It is always processing, the situation. It is always anticipating what comes next. It is always deciding what is familiar and what is new. It is reacting emotionally to events. And that goes on, all day long.
So what are the best ways to communicate effectively with the system one in other people?
Well, anything that activates emotion, that, arouses emotional responses, is a way, it talks directly to system one, including many things that we're not aware of. You mentioned somebody looking like an old teacher of yours. The use of favorable words, the facial expression. People tend to mimic the expressions of the people that they talk to. And so, if you have a smiling face and a genuinely happy face, it will tend to be reciprocated without the other person being aware that you're doing it to them. People mimic each other's movements and posture. So we do a lot to influence other people, and most of what we do to influence other people, we do automatically.
Mm-hmm. So given that our brains do fairly often get things wrong, it would seem sensible to fact-check our conclusions, but often we end up with confirmation bias.
That's absolutely true. I mean, there is ongoing monitoring, and you know, we know that this monitoring is what I call a system two activity because it is effortful. So when you are busy in different ways, your ability to monitor yourself drops. And that monitoring is going on all the time. But system two, as I've described it, you know, these are both metaphors. But system two is lazy and tires easily. So it's easy for ideas from system one or thoughts or mistakes to actually get into behavior and be, as it were, endorsed by system two. Although system two, in a more reflective, more effortful mode, would be capable of stopping them.
And I guess it's important to stop here and recognize that we can't knock system one too much, because if we had to use system two all the time, every experience, including, you know, brushing our teeth, things we'd done 10,000 times, would seem brand new and we would get very little done.
Absolutely. I mean, system two, deliberate thinking is not an alternative way of running our life. We indeed don't think when we're brushing our teeth or shaving. We can do these things. And that's the indication. We can do these things while thinking of something else. So they are automatic, and everything automatic, you know, in the scheme of things that I propose in the book, which is fairly common in psychology, everything that's automatic would belong to system one.
Daniel, what is hindsight bias?
Hindsight bias is a very curious thing. It is that when something happens, an event that is surprising, say, and you think about it later, well, two things happen immediately. In the first place, you make sense of it. So we are just awfully good at spinning stories about events and at being unsurprised by events, because we figure out immediately a plausible story that leads to that event. The bias of hindsight is that you cannot really reconstruct that the event was a surprise. And that has profound consequences. So when people are surprised and you ask them, you know, they state a probability for an event and say the probability is low. Mm-hmm. So they say it's unlikely that the event will occur, say a probability of 0.1. And then the event occurs, and later you ask them, what was your probability? They'll say something much higher than 0.1. So they genuinely cannot remember what they thought before the event occurs, because the event has changed the model of the world. So that's the hindsight bias.
What is the reason for that? I mean, obviously, as you describe it, we're not talking about people lying and trying to make it look like they understood something. We cannot remember that we didn't know these things before. Is there some evolutionary purpose for this forgetfulness?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, this is really part of the broad function of the way the human mind functions. And the human mind is a storyteller. It creates stories about what is going on. It puts things together, usually in a causal fashion, usually in a coherent fashion. And that happens instantaneously. As we understand the world, we update our model of the world, so we're less surprised by it than we would otherwise be. So the evolutionary function is the storytelling. We are clearly endowed with the ability to make sense of our world, and stories is a good way of doing that. That's the evolution. A side effect of that is that you have one story, and anything that you have learned from the event now belongs to that story. I'll take a minute, actually, just to give you an example of that.
Please go ahead, yeah.
Suppose there are two football teams, and, you know, today you think they're equal in strength. Now they play, and one of them trashes the other. You will now perceive one of these teams as much stronger than the other. You have updated your model of the world. And it's very difficult to undo and to remember what was my model of the world before the game. That is what people find very difficult to do.
And I guess linked into this system of thinking is something called the halo effect, which is where when we see that one football team trounce the other one, we assume that the guys on that team will be good at a lot of other things as well.
Well, yes. I mean, the halo effect is that whenever we learn something, we not only make sense of it, we draw automatically inferences from it. And, You know, so if there is somebody that you like, you will think many good things about them for which you may have no evidence. For example, that they are generous and kind to animals. We can infer those things from looking at a person's face and certainly, you know, from interacting about completely different topics.
I suppose the flip side of the halo effect, it's not so bad to think good things about people, but it's got to also explain things like racism.
Well, certainly. I mean, we have stereotypes and we generate expectations, and they're hard to combat.
Just as we are bad at recalling exactly how we felt about things before they came to pass, we are also terrible at predicting the future. Why is that so, even when we have a great deal of experience?
Well, we're terrible at predicting the future in multiple ways. We're excellent at predicting the immediate future. We have a model of the world, and we operate with that model, and the model is accurate, and we've had a lot of experience. What we're terrible at is predicting long-term developments. So, you know, there was a study some years ago by the psychologist Philip Pitlock, and CIA analysts and pundits and the people who talk about foreign affairs on television are really not able to predict the situation 10 years from now. They're good for next year. They're certainly good for this week. They can explain what happened last week. They're not very good at long-term forecasting.
Now, research into human happiness over the past couple of decades, has yielded so many surprises, one of which is that we wish and wish and wish for things that we're sure will please us, and then they fail to deliver. Where is the disconnect?
Well, again, this is, to understand our mind, you have to understand that we pay attention to things and we don't see everything. We really see what we're paying attention to. So there is that thing, you know, that we've called the focusing illusion. So if you consider life in California, you will think of life in California as it contrasts with living in Dallas, say. Mm-hmm. And probably thoughts of the weather and climate will come to mind. And the climate is presumably better in California than it is in Dallas. So that's the immediate inference from this is that people in California are probably happier than people in Dallas, and that maybe that if I lived in California, I would be happier. But that is because you're focusing on the climate. In fact, climate doesn't do very much to determine people's happiness. So it's what we've called a focusing illusion. Anything you think about, you tend to exaggerate its importance.
And it works the other way as well. People imagine that they could never be happy if, for example, they were to be disabled or suffer a loss of some kind. Most people tend to do all right after a while.
Well, there are some disabilities that remain quite painful. But basically, when we think of a misfortune like becoming paralyzed, what is easiest to imagine is learning that you've just become paralyzed. It's waking up in the hospital and listening to those horrible news. Mm-hmm. That we're good at. Now, what we're not good at is imagining that even a month later, and certainly a year later, things will have changed and we'll be paying attention to other things than our disability.
My guest is Nobel laureate Daniel Kahneman. He's professor of psychology and public affairs emeritus at Princeton University. We're spending the hour talking about his new book, Thinking Fast and Slow. If you've got a question, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Daniel Kahneman. He is a Nobel laureate in economics and professor of psychology and public affairs emeritus at Princeton University. His new book is called Thinking, Fast and Slow. We have lines open if you'd like to join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So we could do an entire show on how fast and slow thinking play into our economic activity. But let's start with this. What is the relationship between overconfidence and capitalism?
Well, the best example is that two-thirds of small businesses fail within 5 years. And, you know, it's fairly clear that the people who start a small business, like, you know, a pizzeria or laundry, they don't expect to fail, you know. And the reason that they do this is probably because they're deluded about their odds. They're optimistic and they're overconfident. They can imagine success and they believe in their success and they believe too strongly.
So it's not, I mean, for the people involved, this is a clearly a bad thing to start and then to fail. But without this, I suppose we wouldn't do a lot of challenging things if we didn't overestimate our odds of success.
Oh, absolutely. I call that the engine of capitalism, this optimistic overconfidence. Entrepreneurs are very optimistic. And, you know, for many entrepreneurs, that will lead them to fail at least once, perhaps many times. For society, the fact that there is a lot of entrepreneurship is clearly a major advantage, and it does help, basically, the prosperity of us all.
Let's talk about framing. This gets in the way of a lot of logical decisions, and in the book you share an example of two drivers looking to save fuel over the course of a year. You have Adam, who trades in a 12-mile-per-gallon clunker for one that gets 14 miles per gallon, while Beth trades in her 30-mile-per-gallon model to one that gets 40. Now, we assume very quickly that Beth is making the better choice, but a closer look suggests otherwise.
Well, it turns out when you do that, actually, I think you may have it backwards. The question is, how much fuel will be saved over a year if, you know, a gas guzzler reduces its use of gas or, you know, much more economical car? And it turns out that the gas guzzler who saves, you know, a smaller percentage will actually reduce his or her consumption. Beth, I think that would be her consumption. She will reduce her consumption more than Adam would. You see that much more clearly if instead of doing miles per gallon, which is the American way of expressing this, you express it in gallons per mile. It turns out that that gives you a much better understanding of how much fuel you will actually use and how much you will save by going from one car to another.
So if they both drive 10,000 miles in a year, the person, even with the 14-mile-per-gallon car, is still saving more gallons of fuel ultimately.
Oh, certainly, but he's saving less than the person. Yes, he's saving more than the person who is actually you know, more economical to begin with.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go to the phones now and speak with Mark in Argyle. Hello, Mark.
Yeah, good afternoon, and thank you for the program. I was interested if the professor has any feelings about the convergence of psychology and neuroscience. Here he is today talking about brain function and all of these fascinating ideas, and if he sees the possibility of a tighter sort of interdisciplinary sharing between those two areas.
Well, this is already happening. I mean, it's clear that psychology is very rapidly turning into, I would say, almost a branch of neuroscience. And most of the graduate students who come to Princeton, say, and want to study cognitive psychology or social psychology, do brain imaging at the same time. So that link is becoming tighter, you know, almost by the day, and clearly is going to continue to become tighter in the next few years because so many talented young people are moving into that field.
Tell us about the anchoring effect. Most of us understand on some level that we are influenced, for example, by the prices of the things around the one object we want to buy. But in fact, we can be influenced by numbers that are in our head that have nothing to do with the transaction at hand.
Well, we're most influenced by numbers that do have something to do, even if they don't, even if they provide no information. So, for example, if I ask you what are the last two digits of your social security number, and I ask you, is the percentage of nations in Africa higher or lower than, you know, the number that which than your social security number, the last two digits? And then I ask you, do estimate, what is your true answer, your best guess about the number of African nations in the UN? It will be influenced quite strongly, actually, by your social security number.
Hmm.
You considered a particular solution. You considered a particular number. That made it more plausible. This is the way the brain works. Anything that we think about, we generally tend to make more plausible. And we understand things by imagining that they are true. And that produces, that makes us highly vulnerable to all sorts of influences. Anything that people say to us, unless we have decided in advance that they are lying, anything that people say to us, we are naturally inclined to believe, because believing is necessary for understanding.
And this is important as we approach, say, news coverage as consumers of true information. Sometimes the more often we hear something, the more likely we are to believe it's true, whether or not it actually has any basis in fact.
That is indeed the case. There is such a bias. And it's not even a statement. You know, if people repeat the word, the weight of chicken, you know, so they read that word many times, that phrase, the weight of chicken.
Mm-hmm.
And then they are given a number, the weight of a chicken is 6 pounds, the average weight of a chicken is 6 pounds, or 12 pounds, or 15 pounds. They will be more inclined to believe this if they have said the weight of an average chicken is without any number. So the sheer familiarity with the phrase makes it sound true.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Ruben in Plano. Hi, Ruben.
Yeah, Chris, this is Ruben. I'm actually a psychiatrist and a neuroscientist by training, and I was not exposed to Dr. Kahneman's work when I was in med school and training, but I went and got my business degree. That's where I got exposed to work. What I was wanting to, I recently read a statement by a very prominent researcher that, for a particular disease, we haven't been able to prove, we know clinically that treatment X works, but we haven't been able to prove that, although most of the studies have shown that particular treatment doesn't work. To me, that seems like a confirmation bias. So I wanted to see how scientists kind of fall into the confirmation bias while the studies are telling us. So I wanted to get Professor Kahneman's opinion on that.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks.
Well, it certainly is the case that if you expect a hypothesis to be true, if you believe in a hypothesis to begin with, then the way that you will handle information about the truth of that hypothesis is generally going to be biased. And that is true even for scientists. And, you know, they will tend to actually doubt evidence that doesn't conform to their hypotheses. So confirmation bias is very powerful, and it affects us all. And many of the disciplines, actually, much of the discipline that scientists impose on themselves, including peer review and other things, is supposed to control confirmation bias. And it does so, but not perfectly.
Since we're talking about medicine, another really interesting fact here is if you have a patient, say you tell Maria you have a 90% chance of surviving this surgery you need, or you tell her you have a 10% chance of dying during this surgery that you need, depending on which of those two statements you tell her, which both reflect the same set of facts, she's very likely to make a different decision based on how it's presented.
Yes. I mean, what happens is that a 10% chance of dying is much more frightening than a 90% chance of surviving.
Hmm.
And this affects not only patients. It turns out that this affects the decisions of physicians. So the phrasing of the statistics of medical research in terms of mortality or survival actually has a pronounced effect on what people think, what physicians think, is the correct treatment.
So that presents a challenge for people who are publishing in medical journals and certainly people who are teaching in medical schools. Which is the better way to teach people to think about these things?
Well, you know, there is a risk, and there's been quite a bit of research on that, that the language of percentages, people are really not very good with probabilities, they're not very good with percentages, they're better at understanding numbers. And so there are ways of presenting statistical information that people can process better than other ways.
I was looking at a website recently, and they talk about genetic risk for certain diseases. And what they have is they'll give you the numbers, but then you can click on a little graphic, and they'll show you 100 people, and they'll show you how many of those 100 people are sort of shaded in, and that reflects your risk. And I thought that was an interesting way to present the information.
Yes, it is a recommended way to present that information. But it tends, you know, what it tends to do, thinking in terms of numbers, has risks of its own. So if I tell you, for example, about a vaccine that the probability of an accident with a vaccine is 0.001, that looks like a very small risk. But if I say one child in 10,000 is going to be to have a bad outcome with this vaccine, that looks like a lot because you focus on that trial. So there are really biases almost every which way that we present information, and sometimes you have to do it multiple ways to make sure that people understand.
We have an email here from Bill in Dallas who writes, "You describe the system 2 part of the brain as that part that feels a strong sense of agency and authorship of thought and action. I'm curious if any research has been done into how this part of the brain works differently or interacts differently with system 1 in the brains of people who are very religious or who are not religious at all."
I don't know of any research to that effect. So maybe there has been some, but I haven't learned about it, so I can't answer.
We'll save that one for another day. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Ted in Weatherford. Hey, Ted.
Hey, Chris. Thanks.
Sure.
Doctor, on the point of self-hypnosis and the power as a tool of visualization, could you comment on the approach of that and the effect, if any, of change, trying to change?
Well, I do know that visualization is extremely powerful, and there is research indicating that athletes who practice virtually, that is, they imagine themselves carrying out the acts, and they spend a lot of time doing that, that this actually improves performance. So undoubtedly, visualization is a powerful tool and a tool that people can deliberately apply. As to self-hypnosis, I have no expertise, so I don't know how much it, you know, whether it is superior to other ways of concentrating, that I couldn't tell you.
How does it shake out in terms of our desire to win something or to be rewarded and our fear of losing something or being punished?
Well, there clearly is a major difference between the way that we think about gains and about losses. That's true not only of us. There is research, you know, on animals, and animals are more sensitive to losses than to gains, and certainly people are. And that has, you know, many manifestations. If you want to know about your own loss aversion, you can imagine this. We'll toss a coin, and if it shows tails, you lose $100. If it shows heads, you win X dollars. What does X have to be before that gamble becomes attractive to you? That tells you how much more we value losses than gains. And the ratio typically is between 2 and 3 to 1. So people demand, you know, that win 150, lose 100 is actually a very good investment, but people don't like it. They want more than $200 in possible gain to compensate them for the possible loss of 100.
Is that explained by our need for self-preservation, that somehow we it's almost like the devil you know versus, I suppose, the angel you don't know?
I think undoubtedly the response to threats and to opportunities. We are designed by evolution to be more sensitive to threats than we are to opportunities. threats are commonly more urgent than opportunities.
You have an interesting study in the book that dealt with pilots who were expected to go through a particular training exercise. And for a while, it was decided that if they had done very well, one should not praise them because they wouldn't do as well the next time. And if they had done poorly, they should, in fact, be scolded because they would do better the next time. Can you talk about the reality behind those sort of snap decisions that were made about how to handle poor or excellent performance? Yeah.
You know, we see that actually everywhere. So if you look at, Winter Olympics, and there are events where people have performed twice, like the long-distance jump. If you looked at the very best, the skiers who skied the best, who jumped the furthest the first time, by and large, they are likely to do less well on the second time. And those who did most poorly will do better. Most of us feel, this deserves as an explanation. There is a cause for that, for the deterioration of one group and the improvement of the other. But actually, this must happen that way. And it's a statistical fact that it happened that way. But so the pilot instructors that I talked to, and in the incident you mentioned, they had learned from their experience that when they screamed at a cadet for performing some maneuvers badly, the cadet then improved. And when they praised the cadet for performing extremely well, the cadet, the next time, by and large, statistically, it was likely to deteriorate. Well, turns out this is statistical.
So in other words, they would have done better or worse, a bit better or worse the next time, regardless of how they've been responded to. Daniel Kahneman is my guest. He's professor of psychology and public affairs emeritus at Princeton University. He's also a Nobel laureate in economics. His new book is called Thinking, Fast and Slow. We have lines open to take more of your calls now at 1-800-933-5372, or you can submit questions via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Daniel Kahneman. He is professor of psychology psychology and public affairs emeritus at Princeton University and author of the new book Thinking, Fast and Slow. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. That's where we hear from Augustine in Fort Worth. Hi, Augustine.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well, thank you.
Program. I appreciate this program. It's so beautiful. I was going to ask the professor, since we no longer dwell on memorizing, especially in schools, how come oral cultures transmitted culture through poetry and other means to use memory? And now it seems to me like the attention span of kids is so short that it doesn't matter if we use that anymore, and it's just functional illiteracy or functional everyday going that compels them to not dwell on anything, or just let the information pass by so fast, so quickly, without any affecting on the behavior or the changes. So,
I had a lot of trouble hearing this. It was indistinct on my phone.
It was kind of a muddy connection. What Augustine was asking about was the value of memorization in teaching, which is not so much stressed anymore, and whether or not there is research to show that there is value to memorizing things like poetry and other things.
Well, I think there is research, it's a matter of balance. I think there is research indicating that it's good to memorize poems and that things that you remember in school will come back to you throughout your life, and that's useful. Extreme emphasis on memorization, which exists in some part of the world, is clearly not the best way to train people to think on their own.
I want to talk about this. Even a high school level economics class could recite the old saw that wise investors buy low and sell high. Why do our emotions so often get the better of us when we know the rules?
Well, it turns out that the confidence that we have in our feelings is enormous. And really, with confidence is a feeling. And the feeling reflects the coherence of the story we tell ourselves. As I said earlier, you know, the brain is a storyteller. When the story is a good story, we believe it. And statistical facts and mere facts have very little impact on that. We just reject them. If we have a specific story, and especially if it's a personal story, we tend to believe it and ignore the statistics. And that's true of just about everybody, actually.
So are there particular strategies for making sure that we put the brakes on System 1 occasionally and call on System 2?
Well, you know, there should be. The general rule is that when you're making a consequential decision, one that will have consequences in the future, slow down. That I think, is generally good advice. Slow down. Do not ignore your emotions, but slow down and see if you're neglecting something. This is also the case that when you're facing big decisions, talking to other people is useful because other people are more likely to detect biases in your thinking than you are.
So, interestingly, even though they have their own biases, they can recognize them in you better than you can.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, that was the purpose of the book I wrote, actually. There are many books that tell you that they can help you think and can help you make decisions. I don't believe so. But I believe it is much easier to train people or teach people for people to teach themselves, to observe the judgments and behaviors of others and to discover biases and mistakes.
Does overall education or IQ, does any of that make a difference in how often we employ System 2 and how effectively we employ it?
I think definitely yes. This is certainly the case about, you know, IQ is clearly correlated with the efficacy of System 2, and to a substantial degree, although quite imperfectly, it is correlated with self-control, because System 2 is what you pay attention to. System 2 is governed and governs attention, and that is intimately involved in self-control. And both education and, you know, genetic endowment have an influence on that.
So we can we encourage these things in our children, or are they pre-wired?
Oh, no. I mean, there's, you know, there are pre-wired tendencies, but there is also considerable room for education. And so there have been studies of the famous marshmallow test.
Mm-hmm.
A child is offered one marshmallow now or two marshmallows later. And the children who are impulsive at age 4, their prospects later in life are worse than the children who can delay gratification at age 4. But it is also possible for education to change them. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of beautiful research on the marshmallow test these days.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Email address is think@kera.org. We have Steve on the line next in Irving. Hello, Steve.
Hello. My question is, you seem to be explaining everything in a rational mode of thinking, constantly thinking. What are your opinions on, say, neurofeedback or advanced meditation to someone who is in that constant thinking habit?
You know, I don't think I don't think of people as thinking heavily all the time. This is not at all the view that I propose. Meditation is certainly a way. Meditation, in my terms, is a System 2 thing, primarily. It's because it's controlled. You're actually controlling your thoughts and you're controlling your emotions, and you're attempting to develop a skill in controlling your thoughts and your emotions. And to some extent, this is undoubtedly successful. It's very hard to acquire that skill, just as it is very hard to acquire other skills.
Another thing you address in the book is the trend lately to think about ways that public policy can nudge people without determining exactly what they will do, can nudge people toward making the right decisions. First of all, talk about some of the ways that that can be done and the pros and cons and potential hazards of that.
Well, there are many ways in which you can nudge people to make different decisions. Here is an example. Many countries, including the United States or the various states in the Union, offer the option to donate your organs in case of accident as part of, you know, the getting a driver's license. Now, in Europe, there are some countries, I forget exactly the breakdown, but it's about even. Some countries, the normal state is you don't donate your organs. And if you check a box, then you donate them. In the other countries, you do donate your organs unless you check a box that prohibits that from happening, prevents that from happening. The rate of donations is very different in the two sets of countries. It's like 85% in one and 15% in the other. So that is nudging. You are having some effect on what people do by the way that you structure their choice. The behavior economist Richard Thaler has called that choice architecture. And we must present a choice one way or the other. And the way that we frame the choice for people without abridging their freedom tends to guide them one way or the other. In this case, society would like more people to give organs, so it seems sensible to, if there is a bias, to bias it this way rather than the other.
What's fascinating about that is that it sounds like a lot of people don't mind having a decision made for them so long as they have the freedom to change it if they feel strongly.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. You know, people, although it seems to be a very consequential decision whether or not to donate organs, people tend to look at what other people do and to infer what is normal from, you know, from the way a choice is put. So telling people that many people donate organs has a big effect on their decisions. Telling people most people pay tax increases, diminishes tax fraud. So we're greatly influenced by what we consider normal or not, and nudges have a lot, operate a great deal in this way, by teaching people, or by mentioning to people that actually most other people behave in a particular way.
Another big nudge that's been talked about lately is the opting in or opting out of saving in one's retirement account through work, a 401k or a 403b. What's interesting here is that sort of conventional wisdom would say, well, obviously the wiser choice is to put this money away and to opt in to these programs. But now with the economy the way it is, we have to question whether or not the powers that be are in a position to make the best decision. People who have just lost a lot of money may think differently.
Well, you know, I think that the idea of putting saving a fair amount as the default option has merit, but people at any one time, if they run short of money, they can diminish their saving rate. And if they run out of money, they'll be remembered that they need to do something about it. Mm-hmm. Whereas if they don't save enough, there is nothing to remind them.
Yeah.
So it's a very asymmetric situation.
What sort of biases do we have regarding decisions that we've already made?
Well, the most common bias is to think that the decisions we made were pretty good ones. and we tend to really have a biased view of the consequences, and by and large, people experience rather little regret about their decisions. So in that sense, that makes us happier.
And once we go down a certain road, we hang on longer than would seem logical once things start to go south.
Oh, absolutely. That is because, in general, one thing that people hate doing is to cut their losses.
Mm-hmm.
So if I have an option between losing $900 for sure or a 90% chance to lose $1,000, most people will take the gamble because mm-hmm. they hate that idea of losing for sure, and they cling to the chance. In fact, you know, if I have the option, most people, if they're given the option of losing $850 for sure, or 90% chance to lose $1,000, they will gamble.
And I suppose, you know, in a way that's good because it probably keeps marriages together and keeps the economy going. But ultimately, it can lead people into some unhappy situations.
Well, it keeps people in unhappy situations. Loss aversion, you know, the aversion to losses, that asymmetry we talked about, tends to keep people in the same position they are because the disadvantages of alternatives loom larger than the advantages. And that is called the status quo bias. It favors the status quo. And much of the stability of our lives is actually supported by the status quo bias.
So we've been talking about the functions of the brain here, Daniel. So I have to assume that the phenomena we've been discussing are universal across cultures, or is there some variation?
Well, there is a great deal of variation in that cultures, some cultures, promote some ways of thinking and presenting yourself, and others do it differently. So optimism, for example, varies a lot across cultures. Mm-hmm. It's a trait that Americans value, and I'm told that Hungarians do not. So in some cultures, somebody who is optimistic appears stupid. So there are those variations. But the characteristics that I've ascribed to System 1 and System 2, they appear to be built in. I mean, they're a development, basically, of our perceptual system, which we share with animals. And there is little reason to expect that they are different across cultures. The contents of our thought and the way in which we control our thoughts, that is very dependent on culture and education.
Have you come to terms with the fact that your System 1 will remain powerful despite your efforts to keep System 2 on top?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I long ago accepted that, you know, understanding intuition doesn't mean that I can control it. Mm-hmm. I am just as prone to bias as I was. What I'm better able to do is to recognize errors, to recognize situations where errors are likely to occur. And I'm much better at detecting the errors of other people than I am at detecting my own.
You must be a valued friend and colleague for that reason, as long as you know when to pipe up and when not to.
Yes, I think that many of my friends consider me wise when it comes to their affairs, but don't consider me particularly wise when it comes to my own.
Daniel Kahneman is professor of psychology and public affairs emeritus at Princeton University and a Nobel laureate in economics. His new book is called Thinking, Fast and Slow. Daniel, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Well, thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, and our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I am Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.